Lord Spirit be upon my lips. Amen. There's an interesting connection between the two last two readings today. Peter's speaking to the Israelites in the book of Acts, and Jesus' encounter with Thomas in the locked room. Peter says, just at the end of the reading that we heard today, although you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and rejoice with an indescribable and glorious joy, for you are receiving the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. This theme, which you also heard from Jesus in speaking to Thomas, was a common one in the early church, and in fact turned into a greeting common in the early church all around the year, but particularly during the Easter season, and it's one which we use during the Easter season now, where one says, Christ is risen, and the people reply, the Lord is risen indeed. I, in fact, would like to do that a little bit with you. Remember that this expression is one which was said almost lustily, with joy and enthusiasm, because it meant so much. This was so central to people's faith. Christ is risen. And the people replied, thank you. Now, if we were to convert this into the vernacular of our day, probably instead of this more traditional sounding expression, we would say something like, Jesus lives, and the response would be, yes! Right? In fact, if you look on Patricia's door sometime after the service, there is a cartoon on there from Johnny Hart, who draws BC. And it's a very interesting illustration meant to be Peter. And it ends exactly the same way. So if you have a minute, take a look at it. It's very funny. The more traditional expression for us, I think, can still be filled with the same kind of joy. And we mean this both in a symbolic and a literal way. When we say Christ is risen, the Lord is risen indeed, we mean this symbolically because resurrection for us says much about our faith. It's fundamental to our faith. And it's what we look toward and feel about even psychologically, even when we face danger or disease or divorce, any of those things, when we are in the middle of that suffering and oppression, there is a symbolic meaning to resurrection for us. But we also mean this quite literally. When we say the Lord is risen, and the people respond, the Lord is risen indeed, we mean this literally. We're talking literally about Jesus and his resurrection. There's a poem written by John Updike, a very famous author today, but written before he had become famous, when he was still a young man, which really talks about the time of Easter and what this means to us literally. And in it, he looks at how we experience this literal fact in much the way Thomas must have experienced this same literal fact. Thomas, in his encounter with Jesus, was remonstrated by Jesus' presence. Remonstrated means to be, it's a proof, a passionate and energetic, compelling proof. So Peter, in his encounter with Jesus, although he had expressed his doubt before, was remonstrated by Jesus' presence and had to say, when he saw him, my Lord and my God. John Updike brings that same view home to us in a poem, which I would like to read to you. This is the first time I heard this. I was very moved by it. And I'd like to share it with you because of the power of this poem. It's called Seven Stanzas at Easter. Make no mistake, if he rose at all, it was as his body. If the cell's dissolution did not reverse, the molecules re-knit, the amino acids rekindle, the church will fall. It was not as the flowers, each soft spring recurrent. It was not as his spirit in the mouths and fuddled eyes of the 11 apostles. It was as his flesh ours. The same hinged thumbs and toes, the same valved heart that pierced, died, withered, paused, and then regathered out of enduring might, new strength to enclose. Let us not mock God with metaphor, analogy, sidestepping, transcendence, making of the event a parable, a sign painted in the faded credulity of an earlier age. Let us walk through the door. The stone is rolled back, not papier-mâché, but the vast rock of immateriality that in the slow grinding of time will eclipse for each of us the wide light of day. And if we will have an angel at the tomb, make it a real angel, weighty with Max Planck's quanta, vivid with hair, opaque in the dawn light, robed in real linen, spun on a definite loom. Let us not seek to make it less monstrous. For our own convenience, our own sense of beauty, lest, awakened in one unthinkable hour, we are embarrassed by the miracle and crushed by remonstrance. Thomas was crushed by remonstrance when he saw Jesus. And Jesus said, "Blessed are they who have not seen and yet come to believe." Yet if we reflect on the story, we realize that Jesus appeared to all of the disciples except Thomas first. He showed them immediately the wounds in his hands and his side. And so when they then reported this event to Thomas, Thomas said basically, "I have to see it myself to believe it." We often think of Thomas as the doubter among the disciples, but the truth is that the others did not believe without seeing. When the women ran and told them that Jesus was alive, none of them believed the women. And it took Jesus actually coming and standing among them and showing them his hands and his side before they believed. So these were all doubters, not just Thomas. Thomas spoke his doubts out loud, and Jesus took the care and the time and showed the concern to come directly to Thomas and show him the wounds and display himself and his presence before Thomas so that Thomas could believe. So that when Jesus said, "Blessed are they who believe or who have not seen and yet come to believe," he was speaking of no person in that room, not one of them, not one person in that room. He was speaking to us. Because we, the Christians who have come since that time and who hold up this faith in the resurrection, are the ones who have not seen and yet have come to believe. And it is that faith which is central to our lives and to our ministry as Christians. When we say, "Christ is risen," and the people reply, "The Lord is risen indeed," we are expressing that faith. And we say it and we see it when we face death or divorce or disease, when there is crisis. In the middle of that crisis, we can still say, "Christ is risen." And the people reply, "The Lord is risen indeed." If you go to a small church in the inner city, where they suffer unemployment and poverty and crime, you'll find the churches are full. And there is always someone in each of those churches proclaiming the same truth. If you go to South Africa in the worst days of apartheid, still the church was there proclaiming the same truth. If you go to a rich and comfortable city, there will still be faithful Christians who come to church and proclaim the same truth. If you go to Nepal or Iran or China, where the church suffers great oppression, there are still Christians there proclaiming the same truth. It is this truth which has held the church up and held it together for 2,000 years now. In 1917, shortly after the enslavement of the Russian people, the introduction of communism there, after the overthrow of the monarchy, and a people which had been oppressed under the monarchy as well, Lenin sent experts of his out to all of the remote villages to educate the villagers on the importance and virtues of Marxism and atheism. And in one of these small villages, after the commissar had harangued the people, gathered all of the villagers together in the town square and harangued the people for over an hour, he turned to the town priest and contemptuously said, "You have 5 minutes to reply." The priest rose and said,
"I don't need 5 minutes. I only need 5 seconds. Christ is risen.
The Lord is risen indeed.
Blessed are you who have not seen and yet who have come to believe." Amen.